figure out what day it is, how many days are gone, how many days are left, just leave all that alone. And today I wanted to just explain a little bit about that famous, maybe overused word in meditation called mindfulness, exactly what it is, but also more importantly is how it's developed. Obviously, the more what mindfulness is very sharp alertness, which can see what's going on, can see deeply into things, so you're not just seeing things superficially, but you can actually see what things actually are and what's happening. That alertness in the mind is opposite, and we can very easily know things by the opposite. The opposite is that dull mind, the dark mind, which can't see very much. And I think every one of you who's been meditating a while can experience the times when you really are mindful and the times you're not mindful, but it's not a case of just being black or white. It's not that you are or you're not. There are so many different grades and levels of mindfulness. And you go to even the dullness and sleepiness which you'll experience from time to time in this retreat, no matter what's happening. That's natural. And you can know that's a state of very low mindfulness. Yeah, you're dull, but you can't really be aware exactly what's going on. And that is one of the problems, because it means it's difficult to find your way out when it's so dark and murky. And there are other times, a normal state of your consciousness, a sort of state when you're working at home or just doing your very duties, yeah, you're sort of aware, but even that's only just quite low mindfulness. And what happens later on when you come on a retreat, you know, you find the mindfulness grows in its power. You become more alert. You actually see more things. And that's a very powerful indicator that this mindfulness has different degrees, different levels of power and intensity. And if any of you have ever had a very deep meditation, nimitta stage or even better, the jhanas, when you emerge afterwards, my goodness, you know what mindfulness can really be like. What I've called before, for want of a better word, superpower mindfulness. Incredibly strong. So there are these different levels of mindfulness. And obviously, the more powerful that mindfulness is, especially when it's superpower, then you can really see much more deeply into what's going on around you, into what's inside you. If you want to get great insights, quite frankly, you do need the superpower mindfulness. The ordinary mindfulness is just not strong enough. You're just missing too much. The awareness is not powerful enough. In a similar way that maybe this morning you came in here, the lights were dull. Yeah, you could see some people sitting here. You could see me sitting here, but you wouldn't know whether I'd shaved or not this morning because it was just too dark. But if you turn a spotlight on me, then you can see all my stubble. Sometimes that's a terrible thing. In my bathroom down in the monastery, the lighting is not very good, so it's very quick to shave. But every now and again, I go to these hotel rooms to go to conferences. And my goodness, the lighting is so powerful that when I look in the mirror, I can see so much stubble. And I think, my goodness, I haven't shaved yet. You see it all because it's very clear. Personally, I prefer to be in the dull light so I can't see it, just shave and just have done with it. But that's what happens. In the bright light, you can see, you girls, all your spots and your pimples and defects, can't you? But when there's not much light at all, you can't see those things. And of course, that is why you go out romancing in candlelight, because then they can't see all your pimples and defects. In the bright light of the day, I often say that no one would ever fall in love. They put a spotlight on you because everything is seen. And that's like a sort of funny simile about what mindfulness is. In the dark, in the candlelight, in the moonlight, in the nightclubs where everything is dark and murky, you can't see very clearly. In the bright light of day, you can see even more clearly. If you get a big spotlight in front of something, you can see everything there. Everything, even you may think this floor is nice and clean, but you actually put a spotlight on it, you can see all the dirt, all the floors. I remember as a kid, you know, I'm 59, 60 this year. I remember as a kid, I might have been 8 or 9 or 10 years of age. I remember this TV program I saw at home, The Life in Your Carpet. because they actually use these bright lights and magnifying lenses to see actually what was going on inside the carpet on which I sort of sat on and trod on every day in my home. And the amount of bugs in that ordinary carpet. And these weren't ordinary bugs. They looked like some monsters from a sci-fi movie, you know, with fangs and claws. And after that, I was just so afraid of my carpet. When I looked and saw what was, you know, I imagined what was going on in there. Crikey, you don't believe what's going on in there. And then they had another movie about what's happening on your skin. All these beings are crawling up and down your skin, all these little skin mites right now, monsters. And if you saw them, yuck, I mean, they really look gross. But what I'm not trying to gross you out, but it's just like what mindfulness does is actually sees what's really going on there. It amplifies things. It illuminates things. So you see much, much more. So the job in meditation, one of its jobs is actually to increase that mindfulness. There's a bit of a catch-22 situation there. To increase mindfulness, you have to be mindful. You have to see what its obstacles are so you can increase it. So it usually works incrementally. You find a little bit more mindfulness, you can see more of the obstacles, you can overcome those obstacles, so your mindfulness increases, so you can see more. The more you can see, the more you can see where the light switches are to increase the lights, and the more those lights go up, the more you can see where the other light switches are. So you increase your mindfulness little by little throughout the meditation, and throughout the meditation retreat. It just goes up and up and up. You just cannot do it all in one go. You can't just say, I will be mindful. And this is, of course, one of the great mistakes of meditators. They think, just like everything else they do in life, that your mindfulness will be in the power of your will, that you can choose to be mindful, or that you can choose to be still, you can choose to get into jhanas, I can choose to have nimittas. Look, please understand a basic teaching of Buddhism. It's nothing about you. You try to exert your will, and you'll just stop enlightenment happening. So you have to be wise and just follow the process. And don't think that you can be the whiz kid, the smart aleck, and sort of take the shortcuts and get there faster. So be patient and know what mindfulness is and know how it is generated. I have a key story which I cannot improve, and so I repeat it at every retreat. And it's the story of this hillside, on top of which this retreat center is located. Now you all know that just our monastery is over the road, and this monastery has been there for over 27 years now. And I've been there from the very beginning, obviously, and that's why I'm old and worn out building that monastery for 27 years, and it's still not finished. Or what I should say, what's done is finished. But I remember it was about 7 years I'd been living in that monastery, and every time I would leave that monastery or return to it would be in a vehicle, in a car. People would take me to Perth, they'd take me to the dentist or whatever and bring me back again. And it was after 7 years, roughly, I came back for some appointment in the morning. There was plenty of time, it was a beautiful, beautiful day. It was warm without being hot. And it was just a nice sunny day. I asked the driver, please let me out to the bottom of the hill, I want to walk. Now even these days, if I'm in Thailand, if I'm in Sri Lanka, if I'm in Malaysia, people just won't let me do that. They say, no, we'll drive you up. Look, I need exercise. No, we'll give you a lift. Because their need to make good karma is much more important than their concerns about my health. Basically. So anyway, that time it was a Westerner, so they actually let me get out of the car and walk. So they went up the hill, I'll see you half an hour later on. And that was when an amazing experience happened, which I would never forget. There I was walking up the hill, just from the Southwest Highway, looking around, and I just could not recognize where I was. It looked totally 100% different than everything I remembered. And I thought this is really weird because I've been living in that monastery for 7 years. I've been going up and down that hill 2, 3, 4 times a week. And now I was looking and I just couldn't recognize things. And that was so weird, I thought I was going a bit crazy. So I actually stopped, as you would do, you know, stop and, you know, collect your senses and find out what the heck is going on. And when I stopped and stared, the hillside changed again. And I thought, this is very weird. Because when I stopped, I saw things I'd never, ever seen before in 7 years. I can remember seeing this beautiful lichen on the rocks, and seeing some of the tessellated bark on some of the trees, and some little flowers poking up from between the grass. And what I saw, I never realized was there all those years. And what I saw is actually incredibly beautiful. I thought, why haven't I noticed this before? And after enjoying the scenery for, you know, a few minutes, I had to get up for lunch. So I started walking up, but I started contemplating what on earth was going on. And it became quite clear to me the reason why I hadn't seen so much detail and beauty while looking through the window of a car, because the car was speeding. And I realized, just from science, you know, what you see is a chemical image on the back of your eye on the retina. So the light falls on that retina, forms an image, and then the mind can know that image. But when you're looking through the window of a speeding car, not going that fast, it's going uphill, maybe 60, 70, 80 kilometers an hour at most. When you look through the window of a car, you see an image, but before it fully forms, another image comes into its place, dislodges the first, and another image comes pretty quickly afterwards. When you're looking through the window of a moving car, your eyes don't have time to see the image. No image is fully formed. In fact, it's just like a smear of what might be out there. Only the most prominent features, but no real intricate detail. And the colors don't have a time to form. So everything is like pastel. And of course, when I got out of the car, I was still moving, but walking. My eyes had more time to receive the image. So in other words, the image formed on the back of my eye was more fully formed. More details could emerge, and the colors were much deeper. That's why I could see much more. And the extra detail which I saw was so great that it gave me the impression I couldn't recognize my surroundings. The usual stuff, yeah, that was still there, but the extra stuff was so much more, and so much more interesting. It gave me the impression I was looking at that hillside for the very first time. And of course, then I stopped. And that's when it really happened. That's when the image in the back of the eye fully formed. It had all the time it needed for that chemical reaction in the retina to form the full picture with all its details and the colors 100% full. And that's why, when I was still, you'd never seen grass so green. Just the flowers were like fluorescent. Even the gray rocks, it wasn't just gray, there were just so many different shades of gray, and you could see the texture of those rocks. And the whole was full, deep colors, and incredibly beautiful. And of course, that's a scientific explanation for what happens. But afterwards, I realized that how many of us live our lives as if in a speeding car looking out of the window. We go so fast through our lives, always rushing on to the next thing, never stopping and lingering long enough to really appreciate what's here. 7 years I had done that in that car, up and down the road, thinking I understood the truth of that hillside. And I need an experience like that to realize that you have to stop and become still to get real mindfulness and see what's truly out there. Otherwise, the images are never fully formed. The extra thing, which I never expected, but which explains so much, was why is it that when you get into some meditation, when you really are mindful, you get so much joy and happiness? Just like that was the unexpected benefit. It was so beautiful where I stopped and you saw the full image. Now the colours were really rich. It's one of the reasons why I tell people in anxiety and depression conferences, and I just went to one to give a keynote a couple of weeks ago in Melbourne, tell people, what is depression anyway? One of the things with depression is your mind is so dull, the colours are just not there anymore. You know, green is just all washed out, as if, you know, the toner on your cartridge of your printer is all worn out, so you don't get any greens or reds. It's just like pastel, or like the old black and white TV sets. You know, there's no richness, no colour there. Even what you taste has got just no sort of flavour to it. I think some of you who live here know that when I came back from Indonesia a couple of weeks ago, I had a cough. And that was actually, I just must have been a little bit of a flu, because I had no appetite. You know the times when you have no appetite, you eat something, it just doesn't taste good. There's no taste there at all. It just, you know, my senses were dull. But there are other times. I remember, is Bianca here? Was she cooking today? Good job she's not here, because when I first came on these retreats, you know, Bianca, she was the cook. She cooked everything on these retreats in the old days. And I thought, my God, she's just a great cook. I really enjoyed her cooking. And I actually look forward to retreats, you know, so I can get some nice meals cooking. But after a while, I realized, actually, this is why I said it's great she's not here. It's nothing to do with Bianca's cooking. It was all to do that I was getting high in these meditation retreats. My mindfulness was increasing. So actually, it was ordinary food, but because I was very mindful and alert, I could really appreciate it. Just the same as that hillside. You know, when you stopped and were very still, you could see so much beauty in there. So when my mind was very peaceful, I saw so much amazing taste in the food. And that sort of reminded me, it also explained the first meditation retreat which I ever went on. And that was, I was still a student in 1971, I think it was, in Cambridge University. We had a Buddhist society there. We organized a retreat. So, you know, we don't have nice... Uh-oh, it's Bianca now. I'm glad you just missed that, Bianca, because I was just talking about you. The first retreat which I went on, you know, was in Cambridge during the vacation period. And our group, we didn't have a nice retreat center like this. We just hired three boarding houses, you know, which usually the students lived in. So the students were on vacation, so we took them over for a week, for a 9-day retreat. And you know, that was very nice. We had a nice teacher, meditating. Even there, we meditated in our rooms all day. Only came back in the evenings, because it was like a samatha, quiet meditation, and the best place is by yourself. But when I signed up for that, and of course you had to pay quite a bit of money, and that was a lot for a student, it's just, I really sort of wondered, should I do this or not? Not because I didn't like meditation. And the reason was because I knew, you know, from experience and also from the tales of all my friends at university, that the food in boarding houses for students is disgusting. Because remember, this was 1971, and I think, with respect to anybody from England here, the English were never well known for their cuisine. In fact, their cooking was notoriously bad. When I was a kid, it always was meat and two veg, and any taste in those vegetables had been boiled out. They had been boiled to hell before they put them on the plate. So that's why you needed salt, pepper, or gravy, or something to give it some taste. It was tasteless. But that was the cuisine. And I also knew that the worst cooks in the whole country, the bottom of the pile, the ones who couldn't get any work anywhere else, were employed as cooks for impoverished students like me. So this was the worst of the worst. Student boarding house cooking. And I really sort of thought, you know, maybe I should get some sandwiches or go out for a meal or somewhere instead of experiencing this terrible food. And I went into that retreat dreading it. But of course, what happened? It was actually delicious. And I went away from there thinking, Well, I was wrong. Boarding house cooks are really good. And of course, it was nothing to do with the cooking. It's because I was getting good meditation. That's why, because my mindfulness was increasing. And my mindfulness was strong enough that the tiny, infinitesimal bit of flavor left after all of that boiling, I could actually pick up. Normal state of mind, you can't do that. But I could. I was so mindful. There's actually something left in this carrot. And that's actually why it was delicious. And to this day, I know if I go on retreat and if I have a good meditation, that food is going to be delicious and tasty. And it's nothing to do with the cooks. And those of you who've been on many retreats will probably know the same. You've experienced that many times. You get on this retreat, maybe the first couple of days it's not so nice, but in the middle of the retreat it's really delicious food. Look, it's nothing to do with the cooks. It's everything to do with your mindfulness. Because this is a great thing with mindfulness. When it grows, it also enhances the senses. And everything becomes very beautiful. I had a nice meditation this morning, and just walking out and seeing the early morning sort of dawn. It's beautiful out there. If you go out sort of, when you've got to go to work this, later on today, and you go look at the dawn, you can't appreciate anything. But when your mindfulness starts to increase, everything in this beautiful natural retreat center really becomes incredibly nice. Everything. So you're starting to get a lot of joy coming up. Depression is when you can't have any joy at all. Food doesn't taste nice. Flowers, yuck. Full of pollen, getting up my nose and causing me to sneeze. The birds, shitting all over the place. Nothing excites you. But what happens when you get a lot of mindfulness? Everything becomes very powerful and joyful. So that's why mindfulness training has been well known to be one of the greatest cures for depression. It just makes you more alert, you see more beauty, you get more happiness, and your causes of depression just vanish away. Just like the sun burning off the morning mist in the early morning in the cold places. It's misty, you can't see far, and everything is dull. When the sun comes up, the mist evaporates, and you can see everything, and everything is just illuminated by the sun and looks beautiful. Even the little bits of dew on the end of the leaves sparkle like diamonds. It's beautiful. So this is what happens. This is nature. So this is what mindfulness is. And you've experienced those states. You can see deeply, and what you see is enjoyable. That joy is an important part of meditation. I'm just going to focus on that for a few minutes. Because too often meditation retreats were supposed to be joyless. No pain, no gain, they used to say. And that's totally wrong. No bliss, no enlightenment, that's what I say. So what was actually happening became joyless. And joyless to me was a sign your mindfulness is not getting anywhere. It's not strong enough. Because it's a natural joy which will come up. And the purpose of that joy is actually to keep you fixed on the meditation object. I even mentioned a few days ago, you can watch a movie for a couple of hours, but you can't watch your breath for more than a couple of minutes. Why is that? Movie is enjoyable. The breath is boring. Breathing in, breathing out. How long do I have to do this? But if the breath was as beautiful as a movie, it was as beautiful as Beethoven the Fifth, it was this gorgeous breath going in, going out. Would you need any effort to watch the breath? Do ever you put any effort into watching Harry Potter? When the movie starts, do you have to say, I must be mindful, I must be mindful, I must watch. I mustn't think about the past, I mustn't think about the future, I mustn't think about work. Do you ever actually do that when you're watching your favorite movie? Of course you don't. It's just natural concentration. I can't avoid, or resist rather, telling this story of two of very well-known disciples who come most Friday nights to Perth and also help out every now and again in some of our dharmas. And I won't tell you who they are because it's very embarrassing. They told me that they, one evening, on the weekend, they were watching this movie at home, in their lounge room. It must have been a brilliant movie. They never actually told me what the movie was. But after the movie was finished, now finally finished, the credits came up, and so one of them went to the toilet, the other one went to put the kettle on to make a cup of tea. They'd been watching a movie for a couple of hours. When they got up from the sofa, that's when they realized, hey, something's different. There's a few things missing, valuable things. And that's when they realized a burglar had come into the house while they were watching the movie. And look, they were in the sofa. Right behind them was this drawers or whatever it was with all these valuable items on it. And many of those were missing. This burglar had actually gone behind the sofa, maybe 2 foot or 1 foot away from them, and taken things literally from behind their back. And they didn't hear anything. Because they were watching the movie. It must have been a great movie. It's a true story. The burglar had stolen from right behind them because they were just so focused on the movie. And I said, my goodness, if you could only do that with your breath, you'd be enlightened by now. But why can you do that with a movie? And why is it hard in meditation? What's the difference? And there's only one difference. It's the joy. You're really enjoying the movie. It's fun. Now, actually, it does happen. It hasn't happened yet. It will one day. You'll have as much joy in your meditation as the breath. You can't take your eyes away from it. It's just beautiful meditation. It's that joy which keeps the mind stuck on the object. Not willpower. That can't last. The joy does last. It's such a wonderful time. That's why when the mindfulness gets strong, it creates that joy. In Pali, it's called piti sukha. It's happiness and bliss. You don't need to worry which one means which. That's just theory. You just experience it as bliss, as joy, just being so happy. When that comes up, that means you've got the thing, the cause, which will create even deeper stillness. Why? Because you don't want to move. I often say to people when they ask me, I can't stop thinking, it's because you're not happy. That's why you think. If you're really happy where you are, you wouldn't need to think anything. Think is just one of your escape ploys. Just something to do to face the dullness or the despair of the moment. If you're really happy in this moment, you don't think at all. Just having a great time. I'm not going to disturb this with thinking. So in the joyful moment, there is stillness and peace. The joy is what keeps you there. Not willpower, but joy. That's why mindfulness and joy and stillness all go together. Just like in my little story last night about Sam, Atta, Vipassana, and Metta the dog. It is the stillness creates the peace. It is the mindfulness gives you the insight, and it is the joy which gives you the metta. So that's why they all go together. And it's just such wonderful to know they all go together. It's also why that sometimes people say, Ajahn Brahm, what type of meditation do you teach? Do you teach samatha? Yeah, but not really. Vipassana? Yeah, but not really. Metta? Yeah, but not really. And that's why sometimes there's a meditation teacher's trick. Sometimes you get a disciple, and they said they've done breath meditation, but they just found it difficult. So can I teach them a different type of meditation? So they've already done breath meditation, so instead I teach them Anapanasati. And after a while they say Anapanasati is not working. So what do? I teach them loving kindness meditation. And after teaching loving kindness meditation, if that doesn't work, you know what I teach them next? Metta. If they can't do metta, I teach them vipassana. If they can't do vipassana, I teach them insight. If they can't do insight, then I teach them breath meditation. By that time, they forgot what they started with. The trick is that these are exactly the same technique. It doesn't matter whether you're walking up that mountain for peace, for metta, for insight. It's walking up the same mountain.
They're all the same. What is that mountain? It's just letting go mountain. And as I say, just put things down, let things go. Then you get vipassana, samatha, metta, the whole works. You stop. You stop all the walking and trying to get anywhere. You stand still on the hillside. And then you see just how beautiful, how joyful it all is. So basically, the real cause, I think what you will see, the cause for mindfulness increasing, is not you. Not you doing things. Not you getting up in the morning and today I will be mindful. And no, getting a big stick and every time you're not mindful, hitting yourself. That is not the way to be mindful. There was this monastery in Laos before it was taken over by the communists. I knew a couple of monks who'd been there. And this was a real strict monastery. Not the namby-pamby cream-puff monasteries like Bodhinyana. These were real monasteries creating real monks. The abbot would take the young monks for a walk in the jungle all day. The jungle was hot. It was up and down these mountains. It was tiring. And from the beginning of the day right till the evening, he'd been walking for hours. And he'd always make sure that they came to this place in the forest, not far from the monastery. These incredibly tall trees. Trees which have been there 100, 200, 300 years. Tall, magnificent trees. And in the high branches, the monks had built little platforms. Exactly the size of those little mats you're sitting on. High up in the trees. But with no safety railings. And there was a bamboo ladder. And the abbot told the monks who'd been walking all day, hot, tired, and sleepy, up you go. And they had to climb up that ladder, sit on that platform, don't know how many feet above the ground. And the abbot would take the ladder away and say, I'll see you tomorrow. And there these monks were, high up in the trees, just this much to sit on. And if you nodded, that'd be it. Falling off and breaking your neck, you'd die. And you had to do that all night. No sleep, no cups of tea or coffee. And he'd come in the morning. Many monks got great meditation that way. At least those who survived said that. We never hear from the ones who fell off and killed themselves. And so, when we heard that story, there's a couple of us. I wasn't stupid enough to do this. We went to this big monastery. That's actually Wat Bawan in Bangkok. And they go up to the roof. And they sit on the ledge. In the first thing in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning. And of course, some of the monks saw that, and they told the abbot, you know, the present Sangharaja, Somdet Nyana Sangwara, and he locked the door. He said, no, you're not going to do that. I know you Western monks. One of you is going to fall off, you know, very soon, the way you meditate. We were trying to do, that's not the way to get mindfulness. That's just through fear. So don't try and will yourself to be mindful. You can maybe do that, but it's just so tense as you're afraid all night of falling off. Instead, use the stillness, this beautiful make peace, be kind, be gentle path to become more aware and alert. It's a natural path to mindfulness. One of the keys to creating that mindfulness is the first few days to sleep a lot. People say, what do you mean? Sleeping is not being mindful, but it's a cause of mindfulness. You're resting. And because I've seen too many people, the reason why they're not mindful is because physical tiredness. And just you can't fake it. You can't make yourself mindful. If you're tired, if you're dull, you're just sleepy. It's just cause and effect. It's the nature of the brain. It's not working to its full potential because you're tired. And that's why the way I've been teaching is not just to be good to you. I don't need more disciples. I'm not trying to sort of be kind. In fact, I'm trying to get rid of you. And I say this every time. Some of you have been coming to every retreat for I don't know how many years. I've been trying to get rid of you. What do I have to do to get rid of you? Telling bad jokes? Telling the same? No, because I want you to get enlightened so understand what meditation is. So you don't need to come anymore. So you can just be free. But in order to get that mindfulness going, you need to rest a bit. So the body feels at ease. I always emphasize to people, what was the first teaching of the Buddha after he became enlightened? The first teaching of the Buddha was not the Four Noble Truths. The first teaching of the Buddha was the middle way. He said, look, monks, if you force yourself, the word is Atta Gilamatanu Yoga, practices which tire yourself. That's what kilamata means, which weary you. And you're already very weary, just the way you live your lives. And sometimes you come here and you see Ajahn Brahm say, just go to bed, have a sleep. And someone said, yay! They have permission. They don't need permission from me. Do it yourself. Give yourself a break. Because that's what the Buddha did. After being so austere for 6 years, he decided that's no way to get into deep meditation. He actually said, how can a body like this develop the jhanas? So what did he do? He rested, he bathed, he had a really, really good meal, and then he meditated. Because he was resting, he was bathing and eating well, his friends, the other five ascetics, thought, the scallywag, the namby-pamby cream puff guy who calls himself Gotama, he'll never get enlightened. That's not the way to indulge and sleep and eat well and wash and do things like that. You've got to be tough to get enlightened. But the Buddha went against the grain of the times and he looked after his body and then meditated. And that's why he became a Buddha. And that's the first teaching he gave. Balance. Look after the body. And I know when my body is ready, it feels at ease. It's rested. It's got this natural energy. You feel good, ready to roll. That's actually what you should be doing. Mindfulness of your body means that you're caring for it, looking after it. I mention that care because that's an important part of mindfulness. It was about 3 years ago, I gave another talk. I love going to seminars. I get new stories there. This particular story was from this professor of psychology at Stanford University. He was also presenting there. And he came up with a beautiful line at the very beginning of his talk. He said, I just completed an experiment. I gave my students who were doing psychology credits for this experiment. I split the students into two groups. And one of the groups I sent to a meditation seminar, a mindfulness day. And the other group, the control group, I sent to a California spa at the university's expense, where they could have a sauna or a hot bath, these hot stones I've seen in those in-flight magazines which you read. A spa and a massage. So a California spa for the day. Or a mindfulness day at a meditation retreat. I wanted to find out who was more relaxed at the end of the day. So the two groups came back and I gave them this little test to see who was more relaxed. And you'd be amazed, the results. The people who went to the spa were far more relaxed than those people meditating. And of course, just like you, it made everybody laugh. But that was a great way to, because it's a meditation seminar. You say, look, it's better spending your time in a spa. But no, because that type of meditation, that mindfulness, it was lacking the most important point, compassion and kindness. Why do you relax when you go to a spa? Someone is being kind to you. Someone is massaging your feet. I don't know if that actually works, but someone is actually being kind to you. And that bit of compassion and kindness relaxes you. So, mindfulness should always be along with compassion. So if you're mindful of your body, please stroke it. There, Ajahn Brahm. It's all right, Ajahn Brahm. I love you, Ajahn Brahm. You're okay. Does that give you energy? That increases your mindfulness. A little bit of kindness, together with mindfulness, is the important part of the path. If you take out the ingredients of kindness, compassion, it doesn't work. You're not relaxed. The mind is not relaxed. You never get anywhere in meditation. So mindfulness with kindness, a little bit of stillness, and all these three things, they feed off each other, and it grows stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger. And that's what most people experience during this retreat. If you leave out one of those ingredients, you're not still thinking about this, doing that, rushing here, doing this, you'll find you never get much mindfulness. If you haven't got any kindness, especially to your body and to yourself, okay, I've only got a few days here, I'm going to get up at 4 o'clock, not 4 o'clock, 3 o'clock, come on, this is enlightenment or bust. It doesn't matter if I don't get any sleep, I'm going to really put in the hours, and I'm going to sit here. None of this cushion business. I'm going to sit flat on the floor. Come on. Did the Buddha have a cushion? Ah, flat on the floor. Doesn't matter if it hurts. I'm stronger than that. I'm going to teach these other people how to meditate. I'm going to sit here. I'm going to sit here even if my bones turn to dust and my blood dries up. I'm not going to move. Have you ever tried that? I tried that once. I did. I was 18. I'd just gone to my first WASAC in Cambridge. And this monk, I think it was actually Dr. Sadatissa, he read out the story of the Buddha. And it got to that point where it said, and the Buddha sat down under the Bodhi tree. And he made his resolution. Even though my blood dries up and my bones turn to dust, I will not move from this seat until I get full enlightenment. When I heard that, I said, yeah, well, you know, if he can do it, I can do it. He's just a stupid Asian. I'm a Westerner. He hasn't got much education either. I was just so arrogant. So that's what I did. As soon as the talk was over, I went to my room in the cottage. And I sat down there, and actually, I was serious. And I really want to get enlightened, because get it out of the way. I had many other things to do in life, so... There I was. Crossed my legs, sat down. I'd only ever done 25 minutes. 25 minutes was my maximum time of meditation by that time. Because, you know, your legs hurt. I wasn't built for doing this at that time. So even though my bones turn to dust, my blood dries out, I'm not going to move. I was serious. No messing around. You know, if I don't get light, I'm going to die. It's amazing. I did last 40 minutes. My God, I was in such pain by that time. I couldn't stand it any longer. And that's when I got up. And it was just a double whammy. Number one, so I wasn't enlightened. And number two, my blood hasn't dried up yet. It's just the arrogance and stupidity that I really thought at that time I had enough strong will that I could do this. And I realized from that and many other sort of experiences, the will has got nothing to do with it. There are people who've got much stronger will than I have, and you will ever have. They don't get it right. It's not willpower, it's wisdom power. So how do we build up this mindfulness? It's an important ingredient. Again, this is how we do it. You know, as much stillness as you possibly can make, so you're not walking or running up hills. You're going very slowly. Standing. Being still. If you go out for a walk in the morning, don't just go for exercise, moving really, really fast. Every now and again, stop. Have a look at the surroundings. See how much you can pick up. Mindfulness training. Standing and being still. And letting the world outside open up to you. So what happens? You sit there or stand there. First you don't see very much, and then you see more and more and more and more. It's as if the world is opening up to you. That's just like meditation. You sit there and everything opens up to you. You see more and more and more and more. The mindfulness is increasing. And when the happiness comes, please, 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 I beg you, let the happiness come. Don't think that something must be wrong. I'm enjoying myself. I don't know how many people come onto a meditation retreat and think it's like a boot camp or it's some torture camp. Actually, this guy, he was driving me to the retreat center once. That was in Wat Buddha Dhamma years ago. And we're talking in the car, and he was saying he was coming on my retreat, but he was quite honest. He said, "Well, I suppose I'm supposed to come on the retreat. I'm one of the old committee members, but I don't really want to." I said, "Why not?" He said, "It really hurts when you're meditating, sitting there all day. Your back aches, your legs ache, and you're dull." And he said, "He confided, let it slip. He said that meditation hall there, it looks beautiful." But to me, I've called it the torture chamber. So every time he came in, psychologically, here I go again, I'm going into the torture chamber. It must be good for me. That's what he thought, because, the monks had said, meditate, it's very good if you become enlightened. But for him, it's like the torture chamber. When I heard that, I thought, oh my God, what are you doing? This is not the torture chamber. We don't sort of have the sign outside, give up hope, everyone who comes in here. Or what's the other, what was that in Auschwitz? It's work is good or something. It had this stupid sign above Auschwitz. Yeah, was it work frees you or something? Work frees you. Yeah. Talk about spin. But this is not the torture chamber. So I told him, and I said, I'm going to call this place. And I did this every morning. I said, "Welcome to the entertainment center of Wat Buddha Dhamma." It's beautiful to have that change of attitude. Entertainment. I don't mean I'm giving talks. I don't mean that I'm telling jokes. I mean that you entertain yourself by the beautiful peace and happiness which comes when mindfulness starts to grow strong. And that's what happens once the meditation starts to bite and you're having a great time. This is entertainment center. You can't wait to get in here. I mean, that's literally the case. They're rushing in here, getting your seat. Yeah, here we go again. Oh, aho sukhang, oh, this is really good. Give me more meditation, give me more entertainment. Oh, yeah. The kids like that. Why do you get like that? Your mindfulness is strong, you start to see the beauty. When that mindfulness really gets strong, of course, you can see all these little stupid things you do. I've given you lots of tips. I say, look, thinking, you give it too much value. How can you see that? Because your mindfulness is very strong, you say, what am I thinking for? You see why? You're thinking because you assume that a thought will be more valuable than just being still and silent. That's all it is. What you give value to, that's what the mind follows. If lunch is more important to you at 11 o'clock, you'll be out there to the dining room. If meditation is more important to you at 11 o'clock, you'll stay here. That's as simple as it is. Wait for it. One of the days it's going to happen to you. And understand what I mean. You're sitting here. This is much more valuable. But to hell with the food. I'm enjoying myself. That's what actually happens. So this is the insights you see. Why do you see those insights? Because you're aware enough. You can actually see what's actually happening inside of you. Another thing people keep on saying to me. They say, "Oh, I didn't think anything. The thoughts just they came into my mind." No way. I know that because I've been watching my mind with great mindfulness for many years. A thought doesn't come into my mind, never. I go out and look for one and bag it in, and I'm in denial. I say, "Oh, it just came in by itself." No, I didn't do anything. I didn't do it. I did. I went looking for one because my mindfulness was strong enough to see me doing it. I caught myself out. And that's actually what happens. So mindfulness is actually to see all the tricks of the mind. And it's one of the trickiest things. You talk about in Australia, have this, the Dodgy Brothers, car dealers. It was an old sort of, I think it was a sitcom before or something? Lynn, did you used to watch TV before, Dodgy Brothers? Because I know that the politicians would use it, just like you two guys are just like the Dodgy Brothers.
He's a second-hand car salesman. You know all the tricks they used to do to sort of sell you a car. You know, it's just been in an old lady's garage for the last 50 years. It's as new. They have all these tricks to sort of sell you an old bomb as if it's a new car and get more money out of you. That is like your mind. It's so tricky and sneaky sometimes. So in your mind, you can see all those tricks of the mind. You can see them. When you see them, you say, nope, that's it. You know one of the, okay, I'll just tell you a couple of the tricks of the mind, because I haven't got much. What actually happens? Expectation. One of the great reasons why you don't get still. You hear me talk about what's going to happen, and you get still. This is it, this is it, yeah, this is exactly what your bum says. Limiter's going to come next. Jarvis, I'm going to get this better than sex. Yeah, come. And of course, you realize expectation. What is that? You've lost the present moment. You're looking somewhere else. I've seen me doing that too many times. You get really still. Oh, here it comes. And it all falls apart. You've blown it. But now my mind is strong enough, I can see me doing that. And I stop in plenty of time. I notice that sometimes I'm unhappy with the beautiful Nimitta. I want to get the jhana. That is ill will. I don't want to be here. Even though you think you're blissing out, but there's more bliss to come. And so even I'm negative towards bliss. I caught myself doing that when I was in Japan on one of these big Buddhist summits. And they were taking us around Japan, our delegation from Australia. And they put us in this 5-star hotel. I forget what the town was. And because everyone else went to the hot bars and dinner, and I couldn't do that because of being a Buddhist monk, I sat in the room, and I was getting bored. And I said, I just want to go out for a walk somewhere, or just do some meditation or something. And I realized I was just so unhappy in a 5-star hotel, which people pay thousands of dollars to stay in. I just wanted to be under a tree somewhere. I wanted to be in my simple cave. And I realized from that, look, you can be unhappy anywhere. Even in a 5-star hotel, you can want to be somewhere else. And so when I realized that, my mindfulness was strong enough to realize what I was doing. And say, look, stop this. Stop wanting to be somewhere else. This is good enough. It's quiet. It's peaceful. So just go and enjoy. Go and sit on the old tatami mat and just meditate. So that's what I did. And then all the negativity disappeared. I could see what I was doing. I could even hate a 5-star hotel. Even this place is a 5-star retreat center. And you can even hate this place. And we put so much effort into making it comfortable for you. But it's never perfect, is it? You can hate anything. You know, you can even hate yourself. Even though you're a 5-star meditator. Each one of you. So anyway, when you're mindful, you can see all the tricks of the mind and all the things which actually stop the mind getting deeper into stillness and increasing that mindfulness. So once the mindfulness gets strong, you're aware. There's like a tipping point, I say. And that tipping point is when the mindfulness is strong enough, you start to get happiness coming up. That's a tipping point, because once you get to that stage, then you're away. Off you go. You get into some really nice deep meditations, having a great deal of fun. And it just happens all by itself. My job really is to get to that point. Nimittas and jhanas, yeah, I can explain it to you, but that's not really that important. As getting to the stage where the process becomes pretty much automatic. So the point you're sitting there and you're meditating, oh, it's fun. Oh, this is really nice. I had a beautiful meditation. So peaceful, so nice. Oh, yeah. I really enjoyed that. Now that's the stage I want you to get to. And after that, you just carry on meditating, the joy get better, and your mindfulness gets strong. You can see all the defilements, you can see all the stuff that you need to just sidestep to get deeper, and it becomes this beautiful natural process. So I'm trying to get you happy, enjoying your meditation. So I'm going to tell you a good trick, your posture. I've watched you when you're meditating, and your posture is terrible. I'm not talking about the way you put your legs.
I'm not talking about whether your back is straight, leading to the side. I'm not talking about what mudra you put your hands in. I'm talking about the posture of your mouths. You don't smile enough. Okay, there's noble silence, but there's no noble frowning in this retreat center. Frowning isn't noble. You pass each other, smile at each other. You're actually giving other people the gift of happiness. So it's all right to smile at each other as you pass. Smile at each other in your heart. You don't need to get into a conversation. Just what does that do? That creates a bit of happiness. And when you're meditating, you sit down on your chair, sit down on your stool, or whatever else you're sitting down on, and pay attention to your mouth. And deliberately turn the corners up. If you can't do a natural smile, fake one. You'll find that gives you a head start in meditation. Straight away, the mind is joyful. And when it's joyful, it means the mindfulness is stronger. It means it's easier to be still. You're getting ahead. I learned that. Oh, I better stop saying all these stories. When I was a student at Cambridge, the people were very sneaky because they used to have these little receptions. Now, I was a drinker then with free sherry. Really good stuff, no rubbish. This was Cambridge University. So they had all these clubs, they were looking for members. And so you go along there, drink their sherry and say, thank you very much, I'll think about it. But I went to their boat club. It must have been really good sherry or too much because I signed up. The next thing I knew, I was trying to row in these stupid boats. I'm not an athlete. I was a theoretical physicist, not an athlete. I used to like cricket, but I was actually watching it, not playing it. And there I was, and I don't know how they got me to do this. I'm trying to row these boats. It's really hard work. But I always remember once in some race we were in, I don't know how I got into that. I only did it for 1 year, and that was enough. But doing this one race, and that's when they have this coach who's on the towpath with one of these megaphones, giving instructions, shouting at us. And he shouted at me and said, Pete, that's my name, Peter. He said, look at your mouth. You're frowning. Smile. And at that time, and you're young, you're actually willing to try things out. So I smiled. And it really worked. Because it was easier to pull the oar. I had more energy. And I remember that coach. And I remember just what he actually said was actually a brilliant piece of advice. And you find whatever you do in life, you smile and it's much easier to do. So those of you who are on washing up duties, I expect everyone on washing up duties to smile. And it makes it much easier. Yes, I am drying the plates today. I am washing the cups. I am cleaning the toilets. Oh, joy, joy, a host of cows. You'll find the toilets get cleaner. You have more fun. It goes much quicker. And especially when you're meditating. Smile when you're meditating. And it goes much deeper. If you're stuck in a meditation, it ain't working. Look at your posture, your mouth. Turn the corners up, and you'll get a big boost. Simple teaching. I don't know why more people don't do it. And then, happiness, mindfulness, stillness, they all come together until it gets natural. And this great meditation, really happy, you're away. That's mindfulness and happiness. I've given you a few tips on what to do today. Smile at each other. Smile at yourself. Every time you pass a mirror, please look at yourself. Smile. Hi again, it's me. That will help your meditation. It will increase the happiness, increase the mindfulness, and you'll find the whole meditation will get far deeper. It's how we generate mindfulness, not through willpower, through wisdom power. That's how it works. Okay, great. So that's on some reflections on mindfulness. So please enjoy the morning. See what happens. Those who have interviews, I'll be at my seat in a couple of minutes' time. Happy meditating.